The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to America's Web Radio. Today, I want to spend some time on what I consider to be one of the greatest and curious and interesting minds of our time. Mr. Elon Musk is involved in so many different areas that I think this audience will find it fascinating on the many topics that America's Web Radio discusses to find out some of the things that a brilliant mind like Elon Musk, how he thinks and feels about a number of interesting topics. As we move into 2024, and this is the first program of 2024, it's very likely that 2024 will be the year of wars. We have the Ukrainian war that seems to be at a stalemate. We have the Gaza-Israel war. We have so many other areas around the world that are becoming hotspots and that may get exacerbated. Even the Middle East may get much broader with the Houthis and the Hezbollah and Iran getting more involved and all the different hotspots around the world, whether it's North Korea or China and Taiwan. There's so much going on that I think it's important for us to step back and think about what can we do to stop some of this. And one of the great thinkers, one of the great individuals that has studied the history of wars and the history of conflict, it's amazing how he even has the time to do that. But Elon Musk has been a great student of history and conflicts and wars and tactics and what started wars and how can they end. And he's actually been criticized for sort of being a peacenik in many ways. So he is very much a proponent of peace. So I want to start this this hour of delving into the mind of Elon Musk by asking him about wars and conflicts and his interest in establishing some principles around creating peace, because he's got a very interesting idea that I've heard him say before, and he may very well say later on in our broadcast, that if you have a philosophy of an eye for an eye, it winds up with both people being blind. So how do we stop this madness that may be going on? So Elon, give us a little bit of your thoughts on war, conflict, and the criticisms that you have about being a proponent of peace.
I'm generally a proponent of peace. I mean, ignorance is perhaps, in my view, the real enemy to be countered. That's the real hard part, not, you know, fighting other humans. But all creatures fight. I mean, the jungle is a, you look at the, people think of this nature as perhaps some sort of peaceful thing, but in fact, it is not. There's some quite funny Werner Herzog thing where he's like in the jungle, like saying that it's like basically just murder and death in every direction. Mm-hmm. I mean, the plants and animals in the jungle are constantly trying to kill and eat each other every single day, every minute. So it's not like, you know, we're unusual in that respect.
So, Mr. Musk, what you're saying is that conflict and wars and tribal battles, whether it's among humans or among other species on this planet, is not unusual, that we are just part of the rest of the planet, and it is our nature and certainly has been our history to have continuous conflicts and battles of one side trying to gain power and control over others. But as we have evolved intellectually, as we have some moral context to what we're doing, is it not incumbent upon people who are much more intelligent not to have that same warring instinct or to be able to repress it in some way?
Yes. We have much more of an ability to control our limbic instinct for violence than, say, a chimpanzee. And in fact, if one looks at, say, chimpanzee society, it is not friendly. I mean, the bonobos are an exception. But chimpanzee society is filled with violence, and it's quite horrific, frankly. That's our limbic system in action. Like, you don't want to be on the wrong side of a chimpanzee. Yeah, chimpanzee society is a primitive version of human society. They're not like peace loving, basically, at all. There's extreme violence.
Okay, so we've established the fact that Humans are animals, and our animal instincts are to fight and to bicker and to create power and to dominate over other humans, and other animals are dominating over other animals. But we also now admit that a level of intellect ought to overcome some of that and stop the fighting. But we don't see that in the real world today. We see the mentality of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in many parts of the world, especially the Middle East. How would you suggest that we stop this violence, this Hatfield McCoy kind of a fighting where there's a never ending process? Is there, in your mind, a way to stop the violence and change the course of history and creating more peace in some of these areas if certain actions were taken? What would you suggest?
Well, I think that part of the world is definitely, like, if you look up the "there is no easy answer" in the dictionary, it'll be that, like, the picture of the Middle East, and Israel especially. So there is no easy answer. This is strictly my opinion of, is that the goal of Hamas was to provoke an overreaction from Israel. They obviously did not expect to, have a military victory, but they really wanted to commit the worst atrocities that they could in order to provoke the most aggressive response possible from Israel, and then leverage that aggressive response to rally Muslims worldwide for the cause of Gaza and Palestine, which they have succeeded in doing.
Okay, you properly explained sort of the basic reasons for Hamas attacks and what they were trying to do with horrific acts. But let's get back to that original question. What would you suggest we do to stop Israel, or Hamas attacking Israel again after all this, and then Israel attacking more Hamas or Palestinians, to the extent Hamas is decimated, the Palestinians still harbor these ill feelings and ill will towards Israel? Instead of this back and forth, what do you suggest we do to break this cycle of warring in the Middle East?
So the counterintuitive thing here, I think that the thing that I think should be done, even though it is very difficult, is that I would recommend that Israel engage in the most conspicuous acts of kindness possible. Everything. That is the actual thing that would thwart the goal of Hamas.
What a very interesting concept. Conspicuous acts of kindness. Some might think that's sort of turning the other cheek. Why should Israel do something that's a conspicuous act of kindness to people who have come in and slaughtered their own people? Is that kind of like just turn the other cheek?
It's not exactly turn the other cheek, because I do think that there's... I think it is appropriate for Israel to find the Hamas members and, either kill them or incarcerate them. Something has to be done, because they're just going to keep coming otherwise. In addition to that, they need to do whatever they can. There's some talk of establishing, for example, a mobile hospital. I'd recommend doing that. Just making sure that, there's food, water, medical necessities, and just be over the top about it and be very transparent so that people can't claim it's a trick.
Mr. Mouse, tell our audience a little bit more of what you really mean by conspicuous acts of kindness, so that it's not just a... an uninformed, innocent view of the world. What does that really mean when you say it?
Yeah, conspicuous acts of kindness that are unequivocal, meaning they can't be somehow, because Hamas will then, their response will be, oh, it's a trick. Therefore, you have to counter how is it not a trick. And I'm not sure who said it. It's an apocryphal saying, but an eye for an eye makes everyone blind. Now that neck of the woods, they really believe in the whole eye for an eye thing. But I mean, you really have, if you're not going to just outright commit genocide, like against an entire people, which obviously would not be acceptable really shouldn't be acceptable to anyone. Then you're going to leave basically a lot of people alive who subsequently, you know, hate Israel. So really the question is like, how, for every Hamas member that you kill, how many did you create? Mm-hmm. And if you create more than you kill, you've not succeeded. That's the, you know, the real situation there. And it's safe to say that if, you know, if you kill somebody's child in Gaza, you've made at least a few, Hamas members who will die just to kill an Israeli. That's the situation. But I think if the goal ultimately is some sort of long-term peace, one has to be look at this from the standpoint of over time, are there more or fewer terrorists being created?
So if I hear what you're saying is one way to end a particular back and forth conflicts at a local regional level is this compassionate act of kindness. But what about war in general? It sounds like you're saying that just part of mankind's makeup that do you think we'll always have war? Is that inevitable?
Yeah. Well, war, it's safe to say wars always existed and always will exist. Always has existed and always will exist.
You think
there will always be war. This question of just how much war and there's this sort of the scope and scale of war, mm-hmm. but to imagine that there would not be any war in the future, I think would be a very unlikely outcome.
Again, this particular segment is because it looks to me at least, and I think our audience needs to be thinking about this, that 2024 could be the year of wars in various parts of our world. But wars seem to continue to escalate because the weapons, the technology continues to get greater and greater. And we used to think atomic bombs would create this mutual assured destruction so we wouldn't have at least wars between the superpowers. But we seem to be having more and more regional type wars. What is your biggest concern as we try to stop this proliferation of wars in our time?
One of the things that does concern me is that there are very few people alive today who actually viscerally understand the horrors of war, at least in the U.S. I mean, obviously there are people on the front lines in Ukraine and Russia who understand just how terrible war is. But how many people in the West understand it? How many people are alive that remember World War II? Not many.
Well, I hope our audience is understanding the mind of Elon Musk. I wanted to focus on this first part, which I hope isn't too depressing as we start 2024, of talking about the wars that are going on. But I think it is a critical time in the history of the world where we've got some real powder keg developing in with nuclear weapons and even high traditional conventional weapons being used that are accelerating with technology. We've got to figure out a way to deal with these problems. And somebody who has studied warfare as he has, who has been so involved as a great thinker on so many different issues, I wanted to get his thoughts out on the table. But there's so much more to hear and listen and understand about Elon Musk. Please take this commercial break with us and stay tuned with us as we will talk more and more and understand this interesting and weird mind in many ways of Elon Musk.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Hey, folks, this is Victor with the On Point with Victor show. Make sure you listen every Tuesday, 1 to 2, only right here on America's Web Radio, the On Point with Victor show. Remember, folks, I'm not angry. I'm just right. And you can find out why every Tuesday from 1 to 2, the On Point with Victor show, only right here on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio. Today, we are continuing a focus that we did a few weeks ago of looking into the mind of what I think is one of the great thinkers, one of the great intellects of modern day, and that is Elon Musk. Many of you may only know that, you know, he builds Tesla electric vehicles or that he His business is SpaceX sending up rockets that the Americans stopped building. We were using Russian rockets for a long time, and now he's been able to do something stronger, more powerful, more accurate and appropriate as a private citizen building a company around sending up space satellites. And he's been involved in so many more things, and he's much broader than even his entrepreneurship in the capital markets. He's actually a great thinker and reader and studier of so many issues. And I want to delve into that part because we are, I want to wrap up this section, by the way, and so we can move on to some other areas. But we've been talking in the first segment about war and how to solve some of the, constant battles back and forth, the Hatfields and McCoy type of an approach, and an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth kind of an attitude that perpetuates war. One side hits the other one. They almost forget what started it, but they just keep battling generation after generation. So I want to wrap up on that topic and then move on to some other interesting issues. But this is so critical that we've been talking about war, and not just about war, but about solutions. How do you stop war? How do you stop the process? And he has a concept that we've discussed several times now, the conspicuous acts of kindness as a way to sort of stop that process. But one of the most critical issues that we may face in 2024 is this idea of nuclear weapons on both sides of these issues, whether it used to be United States and Russia, and now China obviously is a nuclear power. But now you've got areas like North Korea and Iran that's trying to get nuclear weapons, and you already have had them before in Israel and Pakistan. So it's proliferating around the country, around the world, around the globe in many different ways. And over time, more and more countries are going to get it. Some bad actors may wind up with it. So it's critical that we understand this idea. So let me ask Elon Musk about the idea of and the potential that he sees the potential of nuclear war.
I think we shouldn't discount the possibility of nuclear war. It is a civilizational threat. Right now, I could be wrong, but I think the current probability of nuclear war is quite low. But there are a lot of nukes pointed at us. So, and we have a lot of nukes pointed at other people. They're still there. Nobody's put their guns away. The missiles are still in the silos. There are wars which are tragic and difficult on a local basis, and then there are wars which are civilization ending or have that potential. Obviously, global thermonuclear warfare has high potential to end civilization, perhaps permanently, but certainly, you know, to severely wound and perhaps set back human progress by, you know, to the Stone Age or something. Generally, I think we obviously want to prioritize civilizational risks over things that are painful and tragic on a local level, but not civilizational.
So let's get your thoughts on a regional conflict of some significance that could generate itself and grow into a existential threat for the world if Russia and the United States wind up in this proxy war of escalating to tactical nuclear weapons, if not nuclear weapons. And all of Europe is in danger, or the whole world is in danger. So how do you see that we can end this conflict in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, I think that what is likely to happen, which is really pretty much the way it is that something very close to the current lines will be how a ceasefire or truce happens. But, you know, you just have a situation right now where whoever goes on the offensive will suffer casualties at several times the rate of whoever's on the defense. Because mm-hmm. You've got defense and death, you've got minefields, trenches, anti-tank defenses. Nobody has air superiority because the anti-aircraft missiles are really far better than the aircraft. Like, there are far more of them. So neither side has air superiority. Tanks are basically death traps, just slow moving, and they're not immune to anti-tank weapons. Mm-hmm. So you really just have long range artillery, infantry trenches. It's World War One all over again. You don't want to be trying to advance from either side because the probability of dying is incredibly high. So in order to overcome defense in depth trenches and minefields, you really need significant local superiority in numbers. Ideally combined arms, where you do a fast attack with aircraft, a concentrated number of tanks, and a lot of people. That's the only way you're going to punch through a line. And then you're going to punch through and then not have reinforcements just kick you right out again.
Well, Elon Musk, you proposed probably a year ago some sort of a peace plan. And as we said early on, you have been a very strong proponent of peace in the world and trying to solve these regional conflicts. It really kind of goes with, for those of us on the conservative Republican side, that Biden has been on the wrong issue of almost every foreign policy that we've been engaged in over the last 50 years. And this is no exception. That there's a reason why many people in Congress are questioning our continued funding of this war in Ukraine with very little prospects for a positive outcome for the Ukrainian people or for Europe or for Russia or for us for that matter. And there's got to be a better way. So tell us about your thinking on what you had proposed a year ago in terms of peace, and what's the likely outcome as you see it at this point.
So, I mean, the reason I proposed some sort of truce or peace a year ago was because I predicted pretty much exactly what would happen, which is a lot of people dying for basically almost no changes in land. And the loss of the flower of Ukrainian and Russian youth, and we should have some sympathy for the Russian boys as well as the Ukrainian boys, because the Russian boys didn't ask to be on their front line. They have to be. So, there's a lot of sons not coming back to their parents, you know, and I think most of them don't really have, they don't hate the other side. You know, it's sort of like, as this saying about, like this saying comes from World War One. It's like, young boys who don't know each other, killing each other on behalf of old men that do know each other. What the hell's the point of that?
So summarize your recommendation to President Zelensky in his involvement with this war in his hometown, in his home country of Ukraine. What would you be saying to him?
I would just recommend do not send the flower of Ukrainian youth to die in trenches. Whether he talks to Putin or not, just don't do that. Whoever goes on the offensive will lose massive numbers of people. And history will not look kindly upon them.
Okay, Elon Musk, let's bring this closer to home. Our listeners out there are very well aware of the news constantly about the conflicts potential between the United States and China, whether it's over Taiwan or over the economic growth of the countries and the potential domination around the world. China is intervening in so many different areas, trying to develop their own friends and relationships and trading partners. How do we avoid using your thoughts and your ideas? How do we avoid conflicts with China down the road that could escalate into nuclear powers fighting each other?
There's hardly a battle I haven't read about. And trying to figure out, like, what really was the cause of victory in any particular case, as opposed to what one side or another claimed was the reason. Yeah. So that Athens and Sparta is a classic case. So we know what led up to the Peloponnesian War between the Spartan and Athenian alliance. We know that they saw it coming. And Sparta was really kind of like the leader of Greece. But Athens grew stronger and stronger with each passing year. And everyone's like, well, that's inevitable that there's going to be a clash between Athens and Sparta. Well, how do we avoid that? And they actually, they saw it coming and they still could not avoid it.
I guess by using that example to answer the question, you're saying that even if we know there's a conflict coming down the road, that it's going to be very difficult to avoid it. Give me a little bit more specifics on how you see this conflict developing between the United States and China.
If you know, the United States has been the biggest kid on the block since I think around 1890 from an economic standpoint. So the United States has been the economic, most powerful economic engine in the world longer than anyone's been alive. And the foundation of war is economics. Now we have a situation in the case of China where the economy is likely to be two, perhaps three times larger than that of the U.S. So imagine you're the biggest kid on the block for as long as anyone can remember, and suddenly a kid comes along who's twice your size.
Very interesting analogy. So you work a lot in China. You do a lot of manufacturing in the United States. You do a lot of manufacturing in China. What are some of the things that you see in this potential conflict that maybe people otherwise don't see or don't? We don't really know that much about China as a general public. So tell us some insights as to the culture, the nature of the people that might have an impact on any future conflict.
Well, the sheer number of really smart, hardworking people in China is incredible. There are really, if you say like how many smart, hardworking people are there in China? There's far more of them there than there are here, I think, in my opinion. And they've got a lot of energy. I mean, the architecture in China that's in recent years is far more impressive than the U.S. I mean, the train stations, the buildings, the high-speed rail, everything, it's really far more impressive than what we have in the U.S. I mean, I recommend somebody just go to Shanghai and Beijing, look at the buildings. Now, China, historically, has always been, with rare exception, been internally focused. They have not been acquisitive. They've fought each other. There have been many, many civil wars. Mm-hmm. In the Three Kingdoms War, I believe they lost about 70% of their population. So, they've had brutal internal wars, like civil wars that make the U.S. Civil War look small by comparison.
Those are interesting insights. I'll be sure our audience picked up on one word you used there. Wasn't inquisitive, it was acquisitive, which means, as I understand it, that we're not out accumulating land. They're not acquiring other people's lands through wars. That's a good thing, so that they weren't looking for a world domination in the sense of owning and running countries, of dominating them. And I want to come back to that issue and the comparison between that principle and the United States has not done that either. Is there a common ground there that we can build on? So let's take a quick commercial break, and I want to come back and delve more into this very interesting mind of Elon Musk.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
If you love classic cars, you're going to want to listen to the Classic Car Show with Tom Cox and Richard Lentinello on America's Web Radio. Live every Saturday at 9 a.m. Eastern at americaswebradio.com. Or on demand on your favorite podcast app.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio and Healthcare Insight. Today, we'll continue the discussion with this great, interesting mind. I find fascinating talking to Elon Musk. We've spent a good bit of time this week on talking about his ideas of war, how to solve wars, how to prevent wars, how to be, as he likes to say, a proponent of peace. And now we've sort of morphed over into talking about the potential conflicts between the United States and China and trying to get a better handle on understanding China. I think our listeners out there, if you are paying attention at all, it's trying to understand who and what this China entity is. What are they really trying to do? Who are the people? What are they thinking about? So I want to turn to somebody like Elon Musk, who not only is a great thinker, but he works with the Chinese and many of his business developments. He thinks he understands the Chinese as well as anybody. So let me hear from him explain what the Chinese people are all about, what the government is all about in the way of their own economic and military development as a coming superpower.
From what I've seen, and I think most people who understand China would agree, that people in China think about China 10 times more than they think about anything outside of China. So it's like 90% of their consideration is internal. The good news, the history of China suggests that China is not acquisitive, meaning they're not going to go out and invade a whole bunch of countries. Mm-hmm. Now they do feel very strongly, so that's good. I mean, because a lot of very powerful countries have been acquisitive. Mm-hmm. The U.S. is also one of the rare cases that has not been acquisitive. Like after World War II, the U.S. could have basically taken over the world and any country. Like we got nukes, nobody else got nukes. We don't even have to lose soldiers. Which country do you want? Mm-hmm. And the United States could have taken over everything. Oh, it at will, and it didn't. And the United States actually helped rebuild countries. So it helped rebuild Europe. It helped rebuild Japan. This is very unusual behavior, almost unprecedented. The U.S. did conspicuous acts of kindness, like the Berlin Airlift. And I think, it's always like, well, America's done bad things. Well, of course, America's done bad things, but one needs to look at the whole track record. So America has been, while far from perfect, generally a benevolent force, we should always be self-critical and, we try to be better. But anyone with half a brain knows that. So I think there are, in this way, China and, the United States are similar. Neither country has been acquisitive, in a significant way. So that's like a shared principle, I guess.
Well, of course, the immediate response to that was, what about their interest in Taiwan?
Now China does feel very strongly about Taiwan. They've been very clear about that for a long time. From their standpoint, it would be like one of the states is not there like Hawaii or something like that, but more significant than Hawaii, and Hawaii is pretty significant for us. So, they view it as really the, that there's a fundamental part of China, the island of Formosa, now Taiwan, that is, not part of China, but should be. And the only reason it hasn't been is because of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. China has been very clear that, they will incorporate Taiwan, peacefully or, militarily, but that they will incorporate it from their standpoint is 100% likely.
Well, Elon, I'm particularly fascinated, so I want to go back to this idea of conspicuous acts of kindness to solve international crises between countries or regional areas, and I would actually take it down to personal and family and community level conflicts to show that kind of conspicuous kindness towards others that can sort of break the cycle and the long-term resentment, hatred, arguing, fighting, warring, whatever you want to say there. So let's go back to history because you are a history buff and you've explained that. And I think our audience now buys into the multi-nature of your intellect on these issues. So give us some examples of where this has worked and where it hasn't worked historically that brings you to the conclusion that it is a brilliant answer, a simplified answer, and some would say naive, but a brilliant answer to some of our conflicts internationally.
Absolutely. So after World War One, they made a big mistake. You know, they basically tried to lump all the blame on Germany. And saddled Germany with impossible reparations. There was quite a bit of blame to go around for World War One. But they try to, you know, put it all on Germany. That laid the seeds for World War Two. So a lot of people, well, not just Hitler, a lot of people felt wronged. And they wanted vengeance, and they got it. You kill somebody's father, mother, son, daughter, they're not going to forget it. They will want vengeance.
So if I'm hearing it right, after World War One, vengeance was imposed on Germany. Reparations, all the blame was put on Germany. Certainly they started World War One, but there were causes and reasons behind it, and the penalties and the penalties, whatever came with prosecuting Germany for all the evils that it cast upon the world with World War One were cast on them and created the resentment that ultimately built into World War Two. So now we have World War Two. Did we learn our lesson from World War II, and how might that have been different in your mind of this concept of conspicuous acts of kindness? Did that occur in World War II or after World War II?
So after World War II, they're like, well, that Treaty of Versailles was a huge mistake in World War One, and so this time, instead of, you know, crushing the losers, we're actually going to help them with the Marshall Plan, and we're going to help rebuild Germany. We're going to help rebuild, Austria and the other, you know, Italy and whatnot. So, that was the right move.
So you call yourself a proponent of peace. I guess in some prior decades, you might have been called a peacenik, but not really, because what you're saying is peace at any cost. What you're saying is you've outlined a process for peace to bring both sides to the table, to understand the goodness of what could be. And I think in some ways that might have been, as I'm thinking about it, what President Trump was doing with the Abrams Accord, trying to find a way that everybody can become a winner, and for the United States to sort of act as that catalyst for everybody to get together and realize that there really is an alternative to war, and that kind acts of kindness to each other to get together and trade and value life and prosperity and peacefulness within their countries rather than warring was a way out of all this. So I think that's a very interesting lesson to learn.
Something must stop the cycle of reciprocal violence. Something must stop it, or it will, you know, it'll never stop. Just eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, limb for a limb, life for a life. Forever and ever.
Okay, enough on war, enough on solving of war and establishing peace. I want to get a little bit more of your general philosophy of life and how you look at things. It's so interesting, all the different areas that you're involved in, but I think you see connections between them and always have that other people haven't. So give us an understanding. I understand one of your favorite books is A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Explain that and how that has influenced much of your thinking and philosophy of life and your curiosity of life and the work and projects that you're involved in.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is one of my favorite books, which is it's a book on philosophy disguised as a book on humor. Mm-hmm. I would say that forms the basis of my philosophy, which is that we don't know the meaning of life, but the more we can expand the scope and scale of consciousness, digital and biological, the more we are able to understand what questions to ask about the answer that is the universe. So I have a philosophy of curiosity.
Changing gears again, one of the most important areas that you're working on with this whole philosophy of curiosity is artificial intelligence. And I guess 2024 is going to be a big year in the growth and use and implementation of artificial intelligence in many different industries in many different ways. So tell us about your approach using your philosophy and your insights into so many different creative areas about what artificial intelligence is and should be and how you're working to sort of bring it together to give us the truth if we're actually using it to try to find answers to questions we don't otherwise know.
We are actually working hard to have engineering, math, and physics answers that you can count on.
Mm-hmm.
So for the other sort of AIs out there, the, of course, these so-called large language models, I've not found the engineering to be reliable. And it the hallucination, it unfortunately hallucinates most when you least want it to hallucinate.
Yeah.
So when you ask important, difficult questions, that's when it tends to be confidently wrong. So we're really trying hard to say, okay, how do we be as grounded as possible so you can count on the results? Trace things back to physics first principles, mathematical logic. And then, like I said, once you can count on the logic as being not violating physics, then you can start to build on that to create inventions, like invent new technologies. You know, physics is just understanding, you know, deepening one's insight into how reality works. And then there's engineering, which is inventing things that have never existed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the range of possibilities for engineering is far greater than for physics. Because, you know, once you figure out the rules of the universe, that's it. You've discovered things that already existed. But from that, you can then build technologies that are really almost limitless in the variety and, you know, it's like once you understand the rules of the game properly, and we with current physics, we do, at least at a local level, understand how physics works very well. Our ability to predict things is incredibly good. Like quantum mechanics is, the degree to which quantum mechanics can predict outcomes is incredible.
Okay, I don't know about our audience, but I think you're starting to lose me on the technical issues between physics and engineering and advancing the world with understanding basic principles of physics. I understand the Lord has created this universe with certain requirements of physics that we're discovering as we understand physics with various absolutes in terms of gravity pool or where the universe wouldn't even exist, all these different things that are built into our understanding and learning of physics. But how you apply that to create new inventions is a little bit beyond me. But let's take a quick commercial break, and I want to come back and I want to delve into some of the great inventions and activities that you've been involved in during your lifetime already, and some of your thoughts and dreams and wishes for where we would go with all this to benefit mankind.
This is America's Web Radio. Would you like to have a show, talk about your business, or express your opinion on America's Web Radio? Just email gm@americaswebradio.com and we'll get back to you. Thank you.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio for our final segment that we are looking at and delving into the thoughts and ideas and the mindset of Elon Musk, one of the great thinkers of our time, one of the great entrepreneurs, the richest man in the world right now, with all the different things that he is doing. And so I want to move away from some of the earlier discussion on war and peace and some of his thoughts around those worldwide issues that we may be facing in 2024. I think they're very insightful and create a new potential dynamic for solving some of those problems if our political leaders would actually listen to somebody like Elon Musk. I don't know what his political future might be. I doubt that it's an elected office. But I want to move on now to something that I find personally very fascinating, and that is to hear him talk about artificial intelligence and how, as he's creating artificial intelligence in terms of robots or the application to things like automobile, automatic driving, is Tesla cars out there. But more importantly, how do you develop the idea of intelligence? What does that mean? And how are humans different with their intelligence in terms of the thinking and emotions, the thought process of solving problem issues that Americans and worldwide can actually do very effectively. And so as he's doing these projects in the United States, as he's developing these concepts, using the engineers and the brain power of some of our best engineers and thinkers to develop this, what does artificial intelligence really mean? Because that is going to be a major part of the 2024 year, and that is the expansion of use of artificial intelligence, of robots learning as they go along. They're built in to learn from videos, and they're learning from other inputs. They're learning from mistakes that they might make. How does all that fit together, and how does that relate towards getting closer and closer to human thought? So let's ask him about intelligence in general, and what his thinking is about how he would define intelligence and the intangibles around the idea of intelligence.
Yeah, I think we need to understand intelligence, understand consciousness. There are some sort of fundamental questions of like, what is thought? What is emotion?
Yeah.
Is it really just one atom bumping into another atom? It feels like something more than that. So I think we're probably missing some really big things. Some really big things. Well, some people would call it like a soul, you know, in religion, a soul. You feel like you're you, right? I mean, you don't feel like you're just a collection of atoms. But on what dimension does thought exist? What dimension do emotions exist? We feel them very strongly. I suspect there's more to it than atoms bumping into atoms. What is consciousness? Like, when you put the atoms in a particular shape, why are they able to form thoughts and take actions and feelings? Why does this illusion exist? On what plane does this illusion exist?
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder, either perhaps everything's conscious or nothing is conscious. One of the two. But we're composed of atoms, and those atoms are composed of quarks and leptons. And those quarks and leptons have been around since the beginning of the universe.
Let me interject a personal thought and belief that I think that Elon Musk has not quite gotten to yet, or maybe he has but doesn't want to voice it. We'll hear if he does later on. But the missing link about consciousness and feelings and discovery and curiosity and all those things are not just electrons bumping against electrons. It's that there is a God, that there is a higher being out there that created us in his image. And that soul that he was referring to is really something that God has placed in us and is the reason why he should be believing in a higher power and a higher being. And I think he may be trying to wrestle with that aspect, thinking that there might be a physical, a physics, a mechanical, whatever solution to discovering that, when in reality, it is a God that has placed that in us. So let me go back to him and see what his thoughts are about the beginning of the universe. He's got some thoughts on whether or not there are aliens out there. A lot of people ask him about that. So they haven't asked him, I guess, necessarily about God at this point, and he hasn't expressed his view on that. But let's at least start back with his recognizing that there is a beginning of the universe where all these electrons that make up us existed, and then how they were they put together so that we actually have these things that are beyond physical. We have a soul, we have emotions, we have consciousness. So Elon Musk, give us your thoughts on the beginning of the universe and whether or not you think there might be aliens since you're in space so much with all your satellites.
Where are the aliens? That's one of the like the Fermi paradox question. A lot of people have asked me if I've seen any evidence of aliens, and I haven't, which is kind of concerning, because then I think I'd probably prefer to at least have seen some archaeological evidence of aliens. To the best of my knowledge, there is no proof. I'm not aware of any evidence of aliens. If they're out there, they're very subtle. We might just be the only consciousness, at least in the galaxy. And if you look at, say, the history of Earth, if one is to believe the archaeological record, Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. Civilization, as measured from the first writing, is only about 5,000 years old. We have to give some credit there to the ancient Sumerians, who aren't around anymore. I think it was an archaic pre-cuneiform was the first actual symbolic representation, but only about 5,000 years ago. I think that's a good date for when we're, say, civilization started. That's 1/1,000,000th of Earth's existence. So civilization has been around. It's really a flash in the pan. Mm-hmm. And why did it take so long? 4.5 billion years? For the vast majority of the time, there was no life, and then there was archaic bacteria for a very long time. Mitochondria get captured, multicellular life, differentiation into plants and animals, life moving from the oceans to land, mammals, higher brain functions.
Let me jump in here because Elon Musk is sort of laying out the question about why did it take so long for human life in existence as we know it today to be developed if the world was 4.5 billion years old and we've only had civilization in the last 5,000 years. I think his question I will take as a pure question as opposed to buying into the idea of Darwin's evolutionary theory. I think the reason it's a theory and not Darwin's law of evolution is that it is still unproven. And many believe that, again, with a higher being establishing life and consciousness, the world may not really be 4.5 billion years old. It may be less than that, but made to create as if it looks like it was 4.5 billion years old. But the whole idea that I think he will research and continue to read on and discover may enlighten us all at some point is this whole idea of whether or not there is a higher being that has established all this and all the laws of physics that he keeps researching to develop new techniques and new products. So I hope that he is someone who can shed some light on that as we move forward and either support or find the flaws in the religious theories of a higher being and a supreme being. So let me move on and ask him about the idea of the physics of our universe, of our galaxy, and that the sun is expanding and ultimately may take out civilization, and whether or not that's driving his interest in being what I think he calls a multi-planetary civilization, so that ultimately we will be able to move off of the Earth and onto other planets when the Earth becomes uninhabitable. So what's his thinking about that kind of a long range? And that is certainly long range idea of the physics of our universe.
And the sun is expanding slowly. It will overheat. It will heat the Earth up at some point in the future. Boil the oceans and Earth will become like Venus, where no life as we know it is impossible. So if we do not become multiplanetary and ultimately go beyond our solar system, annihilation of all life on Earth is a certainty. And it could be as little as on the galactic timescale, half a billion years. You know, long time by human standards, but that's only 10% longer than Earth has been around at all. So if life had taken 10% longer to evolve on Earth, it wouldn't exist at all.
Now, audience, I want you to think about what he just said, and I hope you didn't miss it. I almost did the first time I heard this, but that he's saying that, and he's speaking in galactic time frames, if you will, that in 500 million years, the sun will expand and destroy Earth as we know it today. It will be gone. It'll be unlivable. Human life will be extinguished. And that's only 10% of the entire existence of our Earth. And so what he's saying is if it took, you know, almost 4.5 billion years for life to develop and for us to have modern history in the last 5,000 years, it makes a very interesting observation. I never heard from any of my my physics professors or philosophers or anything else, but instead of 4.5 billion years in developing the existence of modern history, if it had been another 500 million years, so life would never have been able to develop in order to before the sun exploded. So, you know, we wouldn't even exist. So isn't that another reason why there had to have been an intelligent being, a higher power establishing all of this, because we are on that thin of ice of never having existed? Obviously something or someone or some power created us so that we would have an existence of consciousness on this Earth. So Elon Musk, is that what's driving you towards thinking we need to get off of this planet? We need to be multi-planetary, interplanetary beings so that we can save ourselves, even if it's 500 million years away.
We need to do it. I mean, it's not, I mean, I suspect that there, if we are able to go out there and explore other star systems, that there's a good chance we find a whole bunch of long dead one planet civilizations that never made it past their home planet. Do you become a multi-planet civilization or not? And if you don't, it's simply a matter of time before something happens on your planet, you know, either natural or man-made, that causes us to die out, like the dinosaur. Where are they now? They didn't have spaceships.
Well, let's leave it there on this interesting insight into the creative, thoughtful mind of Elon Musk that dinosaurs didn't have spaceships. I guess we can all agree and understand, at least I can understand that part of his presentation. So join us again next week as we will get into some very interesting topics, biographies, political issues. We're getting into the voting season, and I'm sure there'll be some good fodder for podcasts and radio presentations at that point in time. If you want to hear more and listen more about Elon Musk, I encourage you to look at any of his writings, check him out on YouTube presentations. It is a fascinating, interesting, insightful, creative, energizing discussion that you may find if you're listening to great minds like Elon Musk. Join us again next week here on America's Web Radio. We'll see you then.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.